Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record and the audio will be available on our website, cfr.org, if you would like to share it with your colleagues and classmates. We're delighted to have Michael Levy with us today to discuss the Obama administration's policy toward climate change and what's happening there. Dr. Levy is CFR's David M. Rubenstein Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment. Prior to joining CFR, he was a non-resident science fellow and a science and technology fellow at the Brookings Institution. He was project director for the CFR-sponsored Independent Task Force on Climate Change. He has testified before Congress, presented to the National Academy of Books on Climate Change and on nuclear security. He is the author of the book on nuclear terrorism, and he is the author of a forthcoming book on the future of American energy that will be out in May. He currently writes the CFR blog, Energy, Security, and Climate, and he tweets at Levy_M. Thank you, Dr. Levy, for being with us. It would be great if you could begin by giving an overview of how President Obama dealt with climate change during his first term and what he will do in the second term.
Thanks, Irina, and thanks, everyone, for being on this call. It's been an interesting 4 years when it comes to climate policy in Washington. President Obama entered office with high ambitions for climate, for his climate agenda. He had a broad plan laid out as a candidate. He succeeded on some fronts, did not on others, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But after about 2 years, climate certainly took a real back seat to other issues in his strategy. But in the last several months, a bit during the campaign, but certainly during the second inaugural and then during the State of the Union, climate has come back, at least rhetorically, to center stage. So I want to take stock a bit of what's happened and then talk about how that rhetoric might be translated into policy on the ground. If you look back 4 years ago, there were two basic strands of the president's policy and the president's strategy. The first was the clean energy elements of the stimulus package, which were focused on bolstering U.S. clean energy research, development, and manufacturing, but also focused on continuing to provide support for clean energy deployment. The second big element was a push for a cap-and-trade program that would have made greenhouse gas emissions more expensive and so steered energy use toward lower carbon options. He enjoyed, at least initially, a considerable success on the stimulus. Basic point, the stimulus passed, and a variety of measures, investments, and other efforts were put into place. And many were effective. For example, an effort to replace tax credits with grants to support clean energy development, wind and solar development, allowed that industry to not collapse after financing had dried up. But of course, the effort also ran into a political firestorm. You've heard about Solyndra, and whether or not the criticisms are exaggerated, and I think in a lot of cases they are, this has certainly left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. And so while we've seen increased investment in government support for clean energy in the last several years, we've also ended up in a place where pushing further on that front and significantly increasing government spending in this area is considerably more controversial than it was even 4 years ago. The other big push was on cap and trade. That was central to the strategy. I don't think anyone in the administration thought that you would deal with climate change just by spending money on the stimulus side. I think everyone thought that you needed comprehensive policy that penalized greenhouse gas emissions. But of course, the effort to pass a cap and trade bill ultimately failed. We could go for a long time over the reasons that that happened, and there are a host of different forces that came together to make that unlikely, not least of which was the economic state of the country and people's hesitancy after the healthcare fight for another big battle over a large piece of legislation. So cap and trade failed, passed into the background. The president talked about something called a clean energy standard, which would have had a similar impact in steering the electricity sector in a lower carbon direction, but didn't push all that hard for it, and it certainly hasn't come to pass. And so we come to the beginning of the second term. And the question now is, what does the president do, given his high ambitions, but a limited set of tools, low appetite in Congress for spending more money, and a perception that carbon pricing of some sort or another, cap and trade, clean energy standard, or a carbon tax are unlikely. So what does he do with a limited set of tools? The first thing I think he'll be focused on intensely is using existing regulatory authority that the Environmental Protection Agency has under the Clean Air Act. He already used it in the first term with a focus on cars and trucks through new corporate average fuel economy standards that aim to substantially increase the fuel economy, the number of miles you can get on a gallon of new cars and trucks between now and 2025. So each year there is a target, and companies are penalized if they don't meet it. The goals for the later years are particularly ambitious, but those are now in place. The final rule has been put in place. There will be a review in 2017 or 2018, but that's largely dealt with for the time being. The place where I think regulatory thinking will be focused is in dealing with existing power plants. There were new EPA regulations put forward last year or the year before for new power plants that essentially require new power plants to have lower emissions than a coal plant. So that means a gas-fired power plant or something zero carbon like nuclear renewables, or in the future, if it's developed commercially, carbon capture and sequestration that takes the emissions from coal-fired and gas-fired power plants and buries them underground. But the tougher challenge is doing something about existing power plants. Because the U.S. power plant stock does not turn over frequently, power plants can be around for decades. We have some power plants that were built around World War II still operating in this country. And so the question is, how do you use existing authority to try and either increase the efficiency of existing power plants or encourage people to replace them with cleaner ones in a way that's flexible enough so that you don't have ugly, adverse economic side effects? And this isn't an easy challenge. We can talk about it if people want to in the Q&A, in the discussion, but there are a lot of technical challenges. Command and control regulation gives you a limited set of tools, and if you can't find flexible ways to implement these sorts of efforts, it's difficult to be ambitious. So the more flexibility you can have, the greater ambition you can exercise. I also see the president moving towards some creative means of trying to move forward on other fronts. He talked about an energy security trust fund in his State of the Union address that would steer money from new oil and gas production to clean energy research. That's a way to try and bridge the divide between people on different sides of the fight over energy. He's talked about offering prizes for technology breakthroughs, for example, in the application of carbon capture and sequestration to natural gas-fired power plants. And he's talked about improving permitting for clean energy and for fossil fuels. So some creative ideas that would help that would aim to try and help move some of these things forward. There's one other big challenge that's arisen, I'd say challenge and opportunity that's arisen since the president first came into office, and that's the strong growth in American oil and gas. That has changed the U.S. energy scene, changed debates over energy broadly, and over climate in particular. And I think it's important to think carefully about how these fit in and to think about the two resources individually. Natural gas right now is mostly replacing coal. Gas is better for climate change than coal. When you burn it in a power plant, it entails roughly half of the carbon dioxide emissions. There have been controversies over leakage of methane gas from natural gas production. I think those are greatly overblown, even though it is important to make sure that we control those leaks. And again, happy to discuss that. I think the two big challenges here are, first, the local issues associated with gas development. Gas development can be done well, but it can be done poorly. And if it's not controlled and done properly, you do end up with risks that should not be acceptable to water and air and local communities. The second thing that needs to be kept in mind is that cheap natural gas won't solve the problem by itself. You'll ultimately need zero carbon energy, and we need to continue on that path. But even in the nearer term, gas prices are going to stabilize, and that means that coal will still be able to stay in the mix in a big way. And while I don't want to suggest a precipitous move away, I think we do need to be steadily moving toward lower carbon sources, including natural gas, and that is going to require policy. On the oil front, life is a bit more complicated. I don't think you can make an argument, like with the case of gas, that more oil production is a good thing for climate change. It's clearly adding to global emissions. But the question is how much and what are the trade-offs and how does this fit into the potential for a broader strategy on climate change? I'm happy to talk about this a bit more. I'll just make a few observations. First, a lot of the projections for U.S. oil production are very much speculative. So before we go trying to figure out what will happen if the United States doubles its production, we should be asking how likely these sorts of outcomes are. The second is that in the global oil market, additions from the United States tend to be largely offset by decisions from other countries, particularly in the Middle East, to produce a bit less oil in order to keep prices from falling and harming those countries' budgets. So the net addition to global oil is considerably smaller than the superficial addition that comes from increases in U.S. supplies. And the other part is that there are benefits that come from increased U.S. supplies. There are economic benefits to the United States from being able to take advantage of that opportunity. I think it's a tough balance to strike. I ultimately tend to argue that we should focus on reducing our demand for oil and on reducing other countries' demand for oil. If we're successful in that, we will help deal with climate change. We'll also reduce the price of oil in a way that makes some of these marginal developments that people are worried about less viable or not viable at all. But I worry that going after various developments point by point does not fails to capture the benefits from them, but also at the same time does very little to deal with climate change in the absence of serious efforts to curb demand. So, Irina, why don't I leave it at that? I'm sure there are a lot of different things to talk about, and I'll look forward to discussing them.
Thank you so much, Michael. Let's open up to the group.
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. And once again, to ask a question, that's star 1. Our first question comes from the University of Puget Sound.
Hi, just want to thank you, first of all, for your speech. My question is, some scholars on climate change argue that it is not so much a question of trying to reverse climate change now, but a question of adapting to it. I'm curious about what steps the Obama administration has taken, both domestically and internationally, with helping countries, especially those that are low-lying island nations, deal with the consequences that are going to occur from climate change.
That's an excellent question. And I think that what most people who focus on this issue would say is that we need to do both, that if we don't try and reduce the consequences of climate change or reduce the magnitude of climate change, then adapting to it will be all that much more difficult and expensive. But that at the same time, we would be naive to think that there won't be problems that we should be adapting to. When I look at what the administration has tried to do on the adaptation side, I see first a serious effort to try and coordinate domestic adaptation activities to provide information that helps people plan. Some of the simplest things that government can do to help with adaptation are to provide good forecasting so that coastal communities can plan appropriately. Internationally, I think it's been a struggle. The Treasury in particular, and some on the Hill have tried to put more money toward helping other countries with climate adaptation, both because it's the right thing to do, but also, to be frank, because it's a strategically valuable step to take. There are others who are out there helping, and the United States should be seen and should want to be a country that is also understanding of the consequences that others are encountering. The United States has put up money in the context of climate negotiations. to help others with adaptation. But again, this is relatively small compared to the scale of the challenge. If I look forward to the next few years, the big barrier to doing a lot of this is, again, a very limited appetite for foreign assistance in general, and a particularly low appetite if it involves climate change. So I would think the administration would focus productively on making the best use of what it has, working through the World Bank and the Global Environment Facility, through multilateral organizations to try and increase help on adaptation, but also, again, focusing on providing information, helping others really understand the risks to agriculture, to water, to coastal areas, not just as a way of telling them that they should do more about climate change, but in a granular way that helps them make adaptation plans, that helps them make their own investments, and that helps private infrastructure investors make the right choices, too.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Carnegie Mellon.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for your talk. So I appreciate your perspective on new oil developments, and I think it makes a lot of sense. I'm actually a Canadian, and I'm interested in the Keystone XL issue. So I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on how the administration is going to proceed with accepting or denying the Keystone XL pipeline, given that it's probably a drop in the bucket in terms of carbon emissions, but could be politically important?
It's a great question. I gave up my license to predict anything about the Keystone XL pipeline after I made a prediction the first time around, and it was wrong. I know that a lot of other people made similar predictions, but they haven't given up their license. Look, if I look at the president's rhetoric, he talks about taking advantage of opportunities from oil and gas production and from driving down demand for oil and boosting clean energy. Something like the pipeline doesn't fit in sort of as a centerpiece, but blocking it doesn't appear to jibe with that broader philosophy. Now, there are other issues at stake here, and clearly this has become very politically charged. I think that the issue that delayed the pipeline the first time, which was largely local concerns in Nebraska, have been mostly allayed. There's a new route, and Nebraska has said that they will accept the development. But when it comes to the State Department review and to any role the White House might play in that, I think that they are going to be trying to balance maintaining support from environmental advocates who have supported the administration and sticking to the tack that they've taken, where they're trying to build a broader tent for the sort of effort that they want to see, not just on energy, but on climate broadly. So again, I won't predict, but those are some factors that I think will play in to the thinking as this goes forward. I would say that if they go ahead and approve it, I would expect other announcements about clean energy and climate to come in tandem, at least as a way of providing something for their supporters to say, some way for their supporters to say, this is a net positive for the country, or at least we've got some significant progress out of this.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Eastern Mediterranean University.
Thank you. My name is Ratiza, and I would like to just find out that in one of the articles, you stated that fossil fuel-based power has to be changed to using energy that is more alternative, like nuclear, solar, and wind. And for me, nuclear seems to be an alternative that is much more expensive and much more harmful to the environment compared to solar and wind. So then, is it still not damaging or still not moving backwards when using nuclear than actually focusing on solar or wind?
Each set of zero-carbon energy sources has its own challenges. Right now, nuclear power has the advantage of having been established at scale. So it provides about 20% of U.S. electricity, about three-quarters of French electricity, and a large fraction of electricity in other countries. It's also a baseload source of supply, which means that it provides regular, consistent supply. Its economics are challenging, but at least they're relatively well understood. Solar and wind energy both have relatively high costs right now, costs that have come down significantly, particularly in the last few years, which is an important opportunity. But that still is a challenge. And on top of that, solar and wind are both what we call intermittent sources. So you can't count on them being there when you need them. Solar tends to be strong when power is most needed. Peak power demands come when people need air conditioning and things like that, and that tends to be when the sun is shining. Wind, conversely, tends to be strongest at night when people aren't using electricity as much. So there are challenges to moving forward, particularly for a large country that can't rely on balancing its electricity supply and demand by importing from others. There are challenges in moving forward on that front. And the third zero-carbon front, carbon capture and sequestration, we also haven't seen demonstrated at scale commercially, and we don't really know how much it costs. So each of these have challenges. When I look at strategy, I'm reluctant to say, let's put all of our bets on one particular set of sources, because it's very difficult to know how they'll turn out. We could continue to see big drops in the net cost of solar power. We could see it plateau, probably not on the module and panel front, but when we start looking at the balance of system costs, and in particular at things like installation costs. With wind, we're going to see a battle between better wind technology and worse locations for wind turbines. At least in the United States, a lot of the locations that are already accessible to power lines and that are very windy have been used up for installations. So each of these has challenges and trade-offs. What I would say is with each of them, you have to deal with the downsides as much as you possibly can. So for nuclear, that means dealing with safety concerns. It means making sure that there are good plans for waste storage, both in the near to medium term, whether that's on-site or elsewhere, and then in the long term, which almost certainly has to be off-site. And internationally, if we're looking at the potential spread of nuclear energy, we have to make sure we divorce that from the spread of sensitive nuclear technologies that can be used to develop nuclear weapons. This is uranium enrichment and plutonium processing. So each source has challenges. I would not want to bet on any one of them, given the importance of making sure that we have options in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from the Texas Women's University. Please go ahead with your question.
I think you may need to get closer to the mic.
Can you hear me now?
I can.
Okay.
Great.
If you were advising President Obama on the energy policy and something he could implement and get results in his second term, what would that advice be and why?
That's a simple question. I'm just kidding. I actually think that the president's broad philosophy of trying to push forward on both clean energy and on taking advantage of opportunities in fossil fuels and oil and gas in particular, makes a lot of sense. What I would like to see Congress react differently, because ultimately these are not things that the president decides for the most part. If I were to single out a couple things that I think the president can do by himself, what I would say first is really focus a lot of effort on trying to figure out how to creatively implement existing authority under the Clean Air Act. Figure out how to make regulations as flexible as you possibly can with as many different options for compliance as you can, because that will allow you to be more ambitious in what you do. So this isn't a simple thing where you can just take the ideas off the shelf. It's actually quite different from what we faced a few years ago. Cap and trade has been studied forever. Carbon pricing has been studied forever. I don't think we have a particularly sophisticated understanding of how to use the Clean Air Act rules. So I would say make sure your people are really digging deep and figuring out how to effectively use these sorts of rules. So that's the first thing, big thing that I would focus on. The other thing I would do that I think is within the realm of the possible and is very much a unilateral thing is I think he ought to really keep up and step up efforts to make the sale to the American people that dealing with climate change is an important thing to do. I know that sounds trivial, but it's really disappeared for the last several years and only returned recently. There was a lot of focus on dealing with climate change for other reasons, because of energy security, because of jobs. The problem with all those arguments is that they're often not enduring. And over the long haul, if you want people to support a sustained effort to curb U.S. emissions and to work with the rest of the world to reduce global emissions, they need to actually care about climate change. I don't think you can sustain an effort over decades based purely on side benefits that people might realize. And the president has a very strong position, a very prominent position, obviously, from which he can increasingly make that case. And I think it's important that he take advantage of that opportunity.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Richard Stockton College.
Thank you. Moving forward, what are the most likely sources of clean energy that will be deployed globally, and how might those changes affect the U.S. and relationships with other states?
That's a tough question. I think it depends on individual countries, and if you look at each country, each one is taking a different path. If you look at China, they are focusing on a wide range of clean energy sources. So you see a very large wind deployment, increasing solar deployment as their industry has gotten built out and had difficulty with global markets. And you also see a lot of investment in nuclear. If you look at India, you saw wind in the past, particularly driven by tax credits in some states. You've seen a lot of talk about nuclear, but not so much progress. And now you've seen a big solar energy program that's actually attracted a lot of attention that I think is very important to watch. If you look over in Europe, you're going to see you're seeing a turn away from nuclear, particularly after Fukushima. And you've seen a long effort to promote renewable energy sources. In some parts of Europe, and particularly in the UK, as well as on the other side of the world in Australia, you've seen a big focus on trying to develop carbon capture and sequestration technology to take the emissions from coal and gas-fired power plants and bury them underground. So I think you're seeing different sources, and again, I think in line with what I said previously, I wouldn't want to predict where this heads, particularly because even in the ambitious scenarios for dealing with climate change, clean energy only deploys in at very large scale in a way that dominates the electricity system over many decades. And predicting the future that many decades away is very tough. So I would say look at the individual countries, look at their circumstances, and look at how technology develops. And I think you'll see a set of different options that tend to be popular in different parts of the world.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the University of Northern Iowa.
Hi there. Thank you for the time. In relation to the 2007 Energy Independence Act and the mandates on biofuel production, do you see cellulosic biofuels as an important solution in the years to come? Or do you see them being abandoned?
I'd like to see them become more important, but I think that the regulatory approach would need to be significantly redesigned for that to happen. What we have is a combination of very high ambition on paper and very low ambition in reality. So each year there's a target set by the legislation and then put in place by regulators. And each year the cellulosic biofuel industry falls short, and the regulation is revised so that they still comply with it, or at least come close to complying with it. There is no predictable large return if you get out ahead of other companies and really try to boost biofuel supply, because you have no idea what the price dynamics will be and what the market will be. So a mandate that isn't actually mandatory doesn't do all that much. There are obviously continuing technical challenges, and you will need some kind of policy support to make cellulosic biofuels competitive. But what I would like to see is either somewhat less ambitious rules, but a regulatory decision to stick to those rules, or a system where the ambition may be very high, but there's just a penalty built in for not meeting it, rather than a revision made each time. That way, at least, cellulosic biofuels producers can anticipate there being a, a, predictable premium for their product if they're able to produce it. But I think given the current structure, it would be hard-pressed to find people who will predict that we will come anywhere close to meeting the ambitions that were contained in that legislation.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Penn State.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for giving this talk. I have two questions relating to the latest climate negotiations that concluded in Doha in December. The first is regarding the Kyoto Protocol and whether that remains relevant when you have so many countries that are exempt and you have so many countries that have pulled out. And then the second question is relating to how the Obama administration will handle the compensation issue, especially as he's caught between domestic opposition and the own promises that he has made in many of his speeches. Thank you.
So the international negotiations have been very tough in recent years. There have been mixed successes. And it's important to distinguish two elements. I think the discussions about the future of the Kyoto Protocol have been, as a matter of substance, very unsuccessful. That's not surprising. The Kyoto Protocol covers a minority of global emissions, and it does not set up a structure that can be brought into the rest of the world. And so the shortfalls you see are shortfalls in participation in Kyoto and stringency in Kyoto. I wouldn't invest too much concern in that. The bigger question is, can we put a decent international structure in place that helps countries build on each other's efforts and gain trust in each other's efforts? Copenhagen took a step in that direction several years ago by coming up with broad guidelines, and the Cancun talks, I think, were quite pivotal the next year in taking that and making it into a form that was accepted by far more countries. What we now have is a slow walk toward a 2015 deadline for another global arrangement. I think that if the ambition is set right, something can be done, but the focus should be on things that the UN process can do better than others, not on the things, frankly, that other processes can do more effectively. That means providing transparency for countries. It may mean some efforts to help share technology. And it could involve, I think, a focus on trying to facilitate help on adaptation to climate change. But when we look at the international scene, I think it's critical to continue to look not just at the UN process, but at other efforts that can be made multilaterally, both politically and substantively, to deal with climate change. Politically, we have things like the Major Economies Forum. There has been a decision to start talking about climate finance in the context of the G20. There are regional groupings that try to figure out how to cooperate. For example, APEC, Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, recently came to mutual agreement to decrease tariffs on clean energy on a wide range of clean energy goods, making it cheaper and easier to deploy those. And we also have things that are outside the province of high diplomacy but are very consequential, whether through the United Nations Development Program or the World Bank, or other institutions that help countries deal with the technical challenges and the institutional challenges, in the case of the banks, some of the financing challenges, in moving forward on climate change. I think we focus on these big, high-profile negotiations, but a lot of these other international institutional efforts are just as important. On the compensation issue, I'm not entirely sure exactly what you're at. If you're talking about U.S. compensation for climate damages to other countries, I don't think that's a productive avenue for discussion. And the United States has made it clear that it's not going to pay into some sort of compensation fund. I see no political prospect for that changing. And I think it's more constructive to look at how different countries can cooperate, including through assistance from the United States to other countries to support a transition to cleaner energy and to lower carbon fuels. I think that's a much more constructive area to find ways that the various countries can work together. I think focusing on compensation, it's been made clear year after year after year that is not going to make progress in the international talks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the University of Minnesota.
Hi, this is Adam, and I just had a couple questions concerning the EPA regulations versus cap and trade. How effective are EPA regulations for addressing climate change with considerations to our economy and actually affecting real change there? And how likely is Obama to use comprehensive regulations through the EPA if Congress fails to pass legislation?
So let's take those in the opposite order, and they're good questions. I think the administration is quite likely to do something through existing authority when it comes to existing power plants. I think the question is, will they be going after a 2% cut or a 10% cut? That is the big set of questions that I think you need to ask. On effectiveness, I think existing authority can be used to make preliminary reductions to U.S. emissions, but as you get substantially deeper, the burden on regulators to make decisions about where the best emissions cuts are and where the most cost-effective emissions cuts are increases. And the argument for the great superiority of some kind of carbon pricing approach, I think, intensifies as you try to cut emissions deeper. Again, there are creative ways to structure EPA regulations. For example, you can ask states to come up with their own individual programs that achieve a particular level of emissions reduction, and then those states can structure those in quite flexible ways. Frankly, they can use carbon pricing if that's the way they'd like to approach things, and several states do have carbon pricing schemes. So there are different ways of getting at deeper cuts in a cost-effective way with EPA regulations, but I think the risk increases greatly as you try to cut deeply, and I don't think that it is a long-term solution to the challenge of reducing U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. Again, there are areas where regulation will be more effective than pricing. A great example is in building efficiency. People don't respond well to prices there, but they do respond well to building codes that make sure that buildings aren't as leaky as they often are and that they are built efficiently so that we don't waste huge amounts of energy. But those don't cover the whole board, and particularly when it comes to changing the power generation system, where you essentially have step changes. You don't have gradual opportunities. You have coal, you have gas at half that, and then you have a variety of options at zero carbon. Command and control authority has some pretty severe limits.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Princeton University.
Hi, my name is Caroline. I'm calling in from Princeton. And you mentioned earlier some of the strengths that the UN framework could provide in terms of transparency and more in facilitating communication between different nations. But you also mentioned the MES, and we are wondering what are some of the competitive advantages of using more of a regional approach that engages fewer stakeholders?
It's a great question. And is the feedback on there? Great. And first I would say I wouldn't conflate a regional approach and one with fewer stakeholders, because there are global approaches that also include fewer stakeholders, the major economies forum and the G20 being leading candidate. So first, I think it's important to start with what smaller groups don't fix. If major players in a negotiation are fundamentally opposed to each other, putting them in a smaller room doesn't change anything. Okay, so some of the utopian hopes that if we just took the UN framework convention process, threw it out, and had had 20 countries or 8 countries or 4 countries or 2 countries, and magically they would agree on things, I think those are misplaced. But there are real advantages that you can have in these smaller groups. And the first is that you can do far more fine-grained deals. If you are interested in doing deals, you can do a lot more. In the global negotiations, you need to find solutions that work for everyone. In a smaller negotiation, you can find solutions that are tailored. So in the Kyoto talks, for example, the basic incentive that was there for developing countries to cut their emissions was the Clean Development Mechanism. One method, one set of rules, and a effort that worked in some places but didn't work in many others. If you have a smaller set and you can tailor incentives, you can do things like work on infrastructure together that facilitates zero carbon energy or natural gas as a substitute for coal. You can deal with security challenges that some countries feel they would face if they shifted to lower carbon energy sources. You can provide cash grants rather than using carbon trading if that's what's critical to getting some lower carbon sources over the edge. So the ability to tailor deals when you have a smaller set is very powerful. And the second really important thing, and Copenhagen, I think, demonstrated this, is that when you have really tough issues to grapple with and you're looking at very new schemes, it's often extremely difficult for professional negotiators to really cross the line. Professional negotiators are basically tasked with implementing visions, but usually are not able to go out and change the vision, at least not in real time. What that requires is national leaders. And what Copenhagen showed is that if national leaders thought it was wise to show up once at one of these conferences, they're not going to think it's wise to show up again. A lot of people arrived in Copenhagen, thought that whatever the substance aside, that the proceedings were a bit of a debacle, and are unlikely to show up for some kind of great heads of state summit again. I do think that when you get down to a smaller group, you're more likely to get the right people at the table. And having the right people at the table can be critical to actually making progress. One more caveat that I should put out there. I think a lot of people have been talking for years about the irresistible logic of moving to a process that involves a smaller set of countries. But aside from preparatory meetings, we haven't done all that much to accomplish it. And a big part of it, I think, comes down to the fact that the countries that really want to move to this process, the United States as a leading one among them, aren't all that prepared to provide benefits to others for joining. People talk about the World Trade Organization as a model, but there's a clear benefit to joining the World Trade Organization. You get better access to other countries' markets. In order to really attract people to a robust alternative effort, I think there would need to be more thinking and more action to really provide a clear benefit to joining that kind of alternative institution.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from San Diego State University.
Hi, thanks for the talk. My question is actually regarding jobs. How do you think the climate change policies will affect the middle class and, you know, just jobs in general in the United States? Thanks.
It's a very, very important question. And it's a critical reason. If you can mute your line, that would be fantastic. I think people will hear better. Thanks a lot. Set aside the fact that we don't want to deal with climate change on the backs of people's jobs, a climate policy that proceeded at the expense of large job losses would not be a sustainable policy either. That's why it's critical to pursue efforts to deal with climate change, again, in as flexible a way as possible, so that you're not putting businesses out unnecessarily in the process of dealing with greenhouse gas reductions. So a few things that I would emphasize there. First, to the extent that you twin a policy to reduce U.S. emissions with a strategy that also expands U.S. energy production, you have a win-win both for jobs and for climate change if you do both of those sides carefully and in the right way. The second thing I'd say is I think we need to focus on the big picture when it comes to jobs. If you look at modeling of flexible but ambitious climate policy, you find that the projected job impacts are quite small, and in particular, much smaller than the impacts of other pieces of economic policy. So if I were advising someone on how to make sure that they deal with jobs consequences of climate policy, I would say instead of spending huge amounts of time on that, focus on the things that can really move the needle on jobs, whether that's education, whether it is getting the right fiscal policy in place, whether it's getting the right immigration and trade policies in place, and so on. So worker training also, particularly in industries that are changing rapidly. So I think it's important to make sure we have the right sense of scale and that we put our efforts into the right parts of this. Again, you can do climate policy badly and have significant impacts on jobs. You can do it well and have something ranging either from a small negative impact to, and this is speculative, a small positive impact because of competitive advantage that could be created in new technology industries.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from St. Edward's University.
Hi. You mentioned the balance that the Obama administration is trying to do between maintaining fossil fuel development and promoting clean energy. And I'm wondering if these two goals are not contradictory. And so if he's trying to stabilize gas prices and maintain or even increase fossil fuel developments, where is going to be the incentive to put in the massive investment into clean energy that will be necessary to scale it up?
So let's take on oil and then gas. On oil, I think it's important to remember that when we talk about increases, we're talking about the production side of U.S. development. And when we talk about decreases, we're talking about the consumption side. So there's nothing about the fact that people put money into oil development that says that there's no money to put into buying more efficient cars and trucks. Okay, so the gap gets closed by declining imports. Are there impacts at the margin? Absolutely. But I think if you look at mainstream modeling of increases in U.S. oil production, the projections, and these come from people who are skeptical of increases in oil production, the projections are that the price impact is quite small. The reality is that what really moves the needle on oil consumption is broader policy and broader world market prices, not the changes in U.S. production per se. On natural gas, it's more complicated because gas is in some ways competing with zero carbon energy and with efficiency to push into the U.S. electricity sector. So far, the primary impact of gas has been to replace coal rather than to displace renewable energy. And the main determinant of the success of renewable energy, aside from technology development, has been policy. When there was not supportive policy in place, or there was the prospect of a collapse in supportive policy, you saw a pullback in investment in these areas. Now that you have a renewal of the production tax credit that supports wind development, you're going to see a big surge in investment, though production will come further down the road. So policy, again, is the critical difference there. Where I worry about competition between gas and zero carbon energy is further down the road. Particularly because that's where we really need to be making a transition to zero carbon energy more broadly. So to the extent that gas is displacing renewable energy right now, the big threat is the threat to the growth that allows for technologies to be improved, for costs to be brought down, so that ultimate transition is more feasible. I think you can safeguard against that with the right kind of government support for technology development and for deployment. And I think more importantly, if we were to try and boost renewables by pulling back on natural gas, I think we would fail on both fronts. I think that instead of more renewables, you would primarily have more coal-fired power, and you wouldn't have the innovation and deployment in clean energy that I think a lot of people believe would happen in that case.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the Brooklyn Law School. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes, hi, thank you. I was wondering if you thought that there would be money for in environmental law in the future in terms of jobs for attorneys to help the environment. Thank you.
I'm pretty confident that there will be. These are some of the jobs that you're going to have one way or another. And if you look at the landscape today, there are opportunities in the legal space for everything from international law when it comes to dealing with climate to oil and gas law that is changing rapidly as we look at development to the sorts of legal advice and understanding that are related to rapid regulatory change. When I talked about the president needing to make sure that he's got people focused on how to creatively use Clean Air Act regulations to increase flexibility so that ambition can be boosted, a lot of that has to come from lawyers who really know how to get inside the guts of these things and to understand how these work. There's also, I think, going to be very interesting opportunities on the business side in things like deal structuring. So, for example, let's say I've got a big building. I want solar on my roof. Because I have a big roof, I'm not using it, and I can put the panels up there and get a decent electricity savings. But I don't want to be a solar operator. I don't want to deal with all this. I want to hand this off to another company. They'll put up the upfront capital. They'll deal with the tax stuff. They'll deal with the building permitting, and then they'll take a chunk of the proceeds from the solar generation. That's a legal challenge, not just a financial challenge, because someone has to figure out how to sort out ownership issues on the roof. They've got to figure out how to make sure that the structure is properly balanced between the different players. I'm talking about the financial structure, not the building itself. But that's just one example. So I think there are a host of different ways that people with legal skills could get involved in this sort of transition.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the Eastern Mediterranean University. Please go ahead with your question.
All right, thank you. This is just something that goes, just a summary of any of the energy sources, alternative energy sources. Which one do you really think is best to really move forward to invest in, instead of trying to invest in so many, but at least one that you think will not harm the environment and will not be turned into a weapon, and something that at the end of the day is practically readily available to everyone else, than something that is just for a secluded population or country, but everyone, so that we can have all sustainable and clean energy for the whole world. Thank you.
I don't think we have that option yet. I don't look out there and say, here is the zero carbon energy source that is perfect, that is affordable to everyone, that has no local environmental challenges, no security challenges, and no technology challenges. If that existed, we would be a lot further along than we are today in trying to deal with climate change. So I'll just I'll reiterate what I said before. I do think we need to focus on a portfolio, but we need to be clear-eyed as to the downsides of each of these options, and there are downsides to each of them. And if we're clear-eyed about that, then we're going to be as effective as we can be, or at least maximize our ability to be effective in mitigating those downsides. And again, I think those downsides exist for every source. I would not want, I think dealing with climate change is important enough that I would not want to bet it on the success of one particular source.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the Texas Women's University.
Thank you so much for hosting this today. Since we're looking for a zero-carbon energy source, and since nuclear is not carbon-based, it makes sense to look for ways to make it a little more palatable. Europe has done it with quite a bit of success, partly because they made a decision to reprocess their nuclear fuels and thereby reduce the amount of waste that they had to store. Do we have any interest here in reprocessing fuel as a way of reducing waste? And is there any other way that we might consider to make nuclear a more attractive option?
That's a great question. The first thing I'd say is it's important to keep in mind that in France in particular, which is the sort of poster child for European nuclear power, the biggest thing that has made that happen is the fact that the industry is government-backed, which means that its financing costs are far lower than they would be otherwise. In the United States, the Achilles heel of nuclear power is financing costs. The money costs a lot to borrow. It takes a long time to build the plant, and so you spend almost as much paying the bank in interest as you do in paying the developer to build the power plant. I'm not suggesting that the United States government should take over energy development, but I think we need to keep in mind that that is a critical difference that has helped determine why France has so much more nuclear power than the United States. On reprocessing, and the jury is out still on reprocessing, it certainly reduces the volume of high-level waste that needs to be stored. It does not reduce the need for storage. It also is economically challenging. And the United States has long made a security decision that it wanted to provide an example so that it could tell the world, you don't need to have reprocessing if you have nuclear power, because we do worry about the spread of reprocessing technologies to countries that have that might seek nuclear weapons programs. So there are complications there, but the United States is doing more research into reprocessing. I'm not convinced that pushing ahead on that front would fundamentally change the willingness of various places to accept nuclear waste, but it's an area where we need to keep on top of it. I would say that the big thing that the United States needs to address when it comes to nuclear power is the cost problem, and I think you can tackle that from two different directions. The first is to reduce the direct costs of nuclear power, and part of that means standardizing a bit more around a smaller set of designs, so that we can also standardize the regulatory process and streamline that. If financing costs are what drive things up and delays drive things up and construction mistakes drive costs up, then cutting back on all of those by having a bit more predictability, I think, could substantially reduce costs. The other thing that could be done for nuclear power is to make it is to penalize its competitors for their greenhouse gas emissions. If you look at modeling of what would happen with a fairly modest carbon price, nuclear often posts enormous gains because it doesn't pay anything for that carbon price because, as you've said, it's a zero-carbon energy source. So when you look at various factors that could tip the balance for U.S. nuclear power, it's very often some kind of proactive approach to climate change that really makes all power plants bear the full environmental cost of what they're doing and the full carbon dioxide cost of what they're doing that pushes nuclear from its steady level for the last several decades to a much stronger upward growth path.
Yeah, 2 minutes, 1 minute left in the call.
Yes, and unfortunately, I think we are out of time. Michael, thanks very much for today's conversation and to all of you for being part of and asking very insightful and great questions. I hope you all follow Michael Levy on Twitter at Levy_M, and you can also read his continuing analysis and perspectives on his blog, Energy Security and Climate Change. It can be found on the homepage of our website, CFR.org. And as a reminder, his book will be forthcoming in May, The Future of American Energy. And this gives you just a taste of what good things will be in that book. So, Michael, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Our next call will be on Wednesday, March 6th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Please note the special timing of this call and Mark Ligon, CFR's Adjunct Senior Fellow for Human Rights, will be talking about business and human rights. And then last but not least, I wanted to let you know of a new exciting feature that we've unveiled on the CFR.org website. We are currently soliciting questions from students, and we'll be showcasing those questions and answers from fellows like Michael Levy and others in our David Rockefeller program. So I hope you will submit your questions. What we're looking for is a question of about 30 words, 140 characters, on, of course, international affairs or foreign policy-related topics. And we hope that you will send through questions along with your Twitter handle so we can follow you. So thanks all.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.